Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over 5 recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top 5 countdown for the week. At number 5, we have a writer for the Washington Examiner calling on Ukraine to bomb the newly opened Crimean Bridge. Tom Rogan implored the U.S.'s newest Eastern European ally to hit Russia's latest infrastructure project with airstrikes in order to render it temporarily unusable in a fantastical operation that he suggests could even receive American military support, while recognizing that Russia would almost certainly retaliate. Rogan believes that the soft power benefits outweigh the hard power cost because of the immense symbolism of Ukraine bombing the bridge, an ultra-extremist position that proves his ideological radicalism. He's basically calling for Kyiv to commit a terrorist attack against a civilian asset, an egregious crime that could in turn provoke an overwhelming Russian military response that obliterates the attacking party, and all of this just to make a propaganda point against President Putin. Apart from how strategically counterproductive Rogan's suggestion is to the same cause of Ukrainian statehood that he purports to uphold, his rant for the Washington Examiner is an abuse of the freedom of speech because it's being used to rationalize terrorism and preemptively excuse it. Not only that, but the author would certainly be investigated, if not immediately detained and interviewed by the FBI, if he publicly urged anyone to bomb an American bridge. Just like it usually happens, though, the infowar aggressor is now presenting himself as the victim and vice versa, with Rogan courting sympathy after he was pranked by some famous Russian comedians and had a criminal case opened against him in Moscow. This is how perception management operations typically work, because they oftentimes see a provocateur saying something absolutely absurd in order to prompt a reaction from the targeted party, after which the victimized person or country's response is then reframed as a hostile and unprovoked attack that feeds into the desired audience's confirmation bias. Whether that was Rogan's true intention or not, it looks like he's trying to become the torchbearer of McCain's anti-Russian crusade after the senator passes away. The next one up is Ukraine arresting the head of the National RIA Novosti branch and charging him with high treason. This dramatic violation of press freedom occurred right around the time when President Putin inaugurated the Crimean Bridge, causing some cynics to allege that it was being done to distract the Ukrainian public from the inconvenient fact that Russia had succeeded in the ambitious venture that their media told them was impossible and even did so ahead of schedule. The security services raided the offices of the Russian media outlet and seized its editor-in-chief, Kirill Vyshinsky, on the pretext that he was engaging in a hybrid war against his host nation because of his reporting on the Ukrainian civil war. They claim that this dual Ukrainian-Russian citizen used his journalist job as a cover to subvert Kyiv's war-fighting efforts. The charges being leveled against Vyshinsky are entirely unfounded. But that's not to say that journalism isn't ever abused to conduct espionage. And a curious case that coincidentally occurred in Russia around the exact same time shows how this can be done. The Russian authorities arrested Roman Sushenko, a Ukrainian Defense Ministry intelligence staffer who entered Moscow supposedly to visit relatives, but was then caught trying to gather top secret information on Russia's armed services and the National Guard, after which he claimed that he was just doing his job as a journalist, despite having never applied for the accreditation to conduct activities in the country, even though that's purportedly his day job elsewhere with the Ukrinform news agency. Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova made it clear that the Vyshinsky and Sushenko cases have no moral or legal grounds in common, though it can nevertheless be said that this, in and of itself, proves the analytical point that's being made. Vyshinsky is a real journalist who's being accused of spying as part of an anti-Russian deep state witch hunt because of his public reporting, while Sushenko is a real spy who pretended to be a journalist in order to infiltrate Russia and send secret intelligence reports back to his deep state handlers. third on our countdown is the U.S. rejecting Russia's warnings that Daesh is assembling in northern Afghanistan and getting ready to pose a threat to Central Asia. Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Oleg Sheremetyev drew attention to this threat during a speech in the Tajik capital of Dushanbe earlier this week at the Countering Terrorism and Preventing Violent Extremism two-day conference, which was recently followed by Pentagon Representative Lieutenant Colonel Cohn Balkaner dismissing this as propaganda and instead insisting that Russia is not doing enough to address the problem of radicalization and terrorist recruitment within its own borders. Even though Sheremetyev spoke about precisely these anti-terrorist efforts at an OSCE counterterrorism conference 2 weeks ago, the U.S. approach towards Daesh's increased presence in Afghanistan has remained consistent in that it continuously denies that the group is growing here and attempts to cast doubt on all of Russia's warnings about this in order to portray Moscow as manipulating this terrorist threat for geostrategic purposes. The U.S. doesn't like that the Central Asian states are working closer with Russia through the CSTO, Mutual Defense Treaty, and with China via the SCO in order to counter this threat, because Washington wants to be the sole so-called security provider in this region. The U.S. is already trying to revive its strategic partnership with Uzbekistan after its new president visited the country to meet with Trump last week, but Tashkent's pragmatic leader is unlikely to do anything that would endanger his state's regional connectivity prospects that he's worked so hard for the past year and a half to expand. This leads to the cynical scenario where U.S. strategic objectives could best be served by seeing Daesh function as an indirectly guided divide-and-rule asset for sowing the seeds of regional chaos in Central and South Asia, just like it previously did in West Asia. To explain, one of the fundamental objectives of hybrid war is to externally provoke identity-based conflict over something as polarizing as religion, for instance, in order to disrupt multipolar, transnational connective initiatives such as integrational institutions like the SCO or infrastructure projects like the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, thus making Afghanistan ground zero for launching northern and southern Daesh-driven destabilization campaigns, respectively, against these two examples. All of Afghanistan's neighbors as well as Russia are well aware of this threat, which deepens their suspicion of Washington's motives for denying the obvious. Two unlikely partners realized what the game was early on and used their shared interest in thwarting the U.S.'s chaotic scenario as the basis for their fast-moving and full-spectrum rapprochement, with Russia and Pakistan having since courageously moved past their history of distrust with one another and into a brand new era of strategic relations that began with Afghanistan, but has since developed continental implications through the exciting prospect of finally bringing together the golden ring of Eurasian great powers. The Russian-Pakistani axis had hitherto been the weakest link in the grand consortium of these two, China, Iran, and Turkey, but is now among the most promising ones. By denying Daesh's growing presence in Central Asia, the U.S. inadvertently strengthened the golden ring that it originally wanted the terrorists to disrupt, with the consequences of this blowback being worse than even the late Brzezinski could have expected. Writing in his now infamous strategy planning book about the Grand Chessboard, he said that the U.S. must do everything in its power to prevent Russia and China from joining forces against America, but after Washington's infowar debacle with Daesh in Afghanistan, the Polish thinker's adopted homeland now has to confront the prospect of these two Eurasian great powers partnering with a multipolar center of Muslim ones in Turkey, Iran, and Pakistan via the Golden Ring. Our runner-up is Iraq's Muqtada al-Sadr's complex balancing act between Iran and Saudi Arabia. The Shiite cleric and former militia leader is regarded as an Iraqi nationalist who wants to prioritize his country's interests above those of its neighbors and the U.S., to which end he's trying to carve out a strategic niche between the first mentioned two as a buffer zone in their region-wide proxy war. His parliamentary bloc just won last week's elections, and while he didn't personally run in them, he's now Iraq's so-called Gray Cardinal because of it, and that's why he recently held meetings with Prime Minister Haider Al-Abadi, and pro-Iranian politician and second-place finisher Hadi Al-Amiri. Al-Sadr is aware of influential Iranian international affairs advisor to the Ayatollah, Ali Akbar Velayati, threatening in February that "we will not allow liberals and communists to govern in Iraq," which refer to the ideologies of the two political parties that he's in a coalition with. So he likely wanted to avoid any problems by finding a way to incorporate his opponents into an inclusive government. Pragmaticism aside, Iranian-backed players probably won't ever trust him after he visited Saudi Arabia last summer and superficially transcended the externally exacerbated sectarian fault line in a move that was widely interpreted as a betrayal by his rivals. In any case, Iran will probably advise its Iraqi partners to compromise by agreeing to work with him for stability's sake, because Tehran can ill afford any more regional setbacks, let alone a low-intensity conflict or even a civil war on its western border. It already has to confront the U.S.'s recently reinstated unilateral sanctions and European companies pulling out of the Islamic Republic in order to abide by them. And just last week, President Putin, while speaking next to his Syrian counterpart in Sochi and celebrating their joint victory over terrorism, declared that "we proceed from the assumption that foreign armed forces will be withdrawing from the territory of the Syrian Arab Republic." His special envoy to Syria, Alexander Lavrentiev, then confirmed that this refers to the Americans, Turks, Hezbollah, and of course the Iranians, though Iran responded at the beginning of this week that it won't withdraw unless Damascus asks it to. Syria is a sovereign state that's capable of making its own decisions, but the combination of Daesh's defeat and increasing Israeli military pressure means that it's more likely than not to request in the coming future that its Iranian and Hezbollah allies depart the country, albeit in what will probably be a phased manner and with the full honor that these loyal wartime heroes deserve. The rolling back of Iran's strategic debt in the Levant will make Iraq an even greater priority for it, especially after al-Sadr's victory and its consequent balancing of the Islamic Republic and the Wahhabi kingdom that his country is wedged between. Though, interestingly enough, these predicted setbacks along its western flank could stimulate an eastern pivot to the countries of South, Central, and East Asia via the golden ring of multipolar great powers that's forming between itself, Turkey, Russia, Pakistan, China, and the former Soviet republics in the middle of them. Should this scenario succeed, then al-Sadr's balancing act might ultimately end up being a godsend for Eurasia. At our top spot, we've got Rosneft drilling for oil off the South China Sea coast of Vietnam in an area claimed by China. The Russian energy giant is involved in the Lan Do oil field that narrowly sits within the southwestern border of China's Nine Dash Line, but is apparently regarded by the company as being under Vietnam's de facto sovereignty. China officially called on all countries to respect its claims, without specifically mentioning Rosneft, but an obvious reference to it, a sign that it feels uncomfortable with this latest development, even though it might eventually turn out to be a step in the right direction. To explain, Vietnam is under heavy pressure from the so-called Quad of the US, Japan, Australia, and India to de facto join what is essentially a Chinese containment coalition, though this disruptive influence is counterbalanced through Russia's Eurasian Union Free Trade Agreement and military deals with its historic partner that have hitherto succeeded in allowing Hanoi to strike a balance between the unipolar and multipolar worlds and the new Cold War. Rosneft's controversial move indirectly introduced Russia to the simmering South China Sea dispute, but this might be a good thing, because Moscow is known to favor international law and negotiations to any dispute instead of push its partner towards waging war in order to settle problems like the US-led Quad is prone to do. China will probably still not like this, because it prefers to handle all sensitive issues bilaterally as a matter of long-standing policy, but might come to gradually see something positive in it. Russia's newfound role could balance out the Quad's militaristic urgings by getting Vietnam to consider entering into negotiations with China about this, with both parties being diplomatically brought together because of Moscow's efforts. One prospective solution that might emerge from this could be for their shared Russian partner to extract energy from disputed regions and share the profits and resources with each of them, per a formula that they agreed to in advance as part of a settlement for officially redefining their maritime border. Russia already agreed to jointly develop the energy resources located within the so-called gray zone of former dispute with NATO member Norway and the Barents Sea following a 2010 accord. So it's conceivable that Rosneft could play the third-party extraction role in facilitating this same sort of solution between Vietnam and China if they ever reach a similar agreement on the South China Sea. That's why, even though it might seem unlikely at this point in time, China could ultimately end up thanking Russia for indirectly getting involved in this dispute. Alright folks, this wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for tuning into my program. Hope you all have a nice weekend and tune in again next week. Thank you. Bye.